get us into the force, they scream, without a rope, without a gun.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Inside Track, episode number 17. My name's David Condon, and welcome. I'd like to introduce you now to my co-host, Jason Kennedy. Hello, Jay. How you doing, man?
I'm fine, thank you, Dave.
How's your week been, man?
Well, for the first time in a number of weeks, it's been an interesting week.
Oh, pray tell.
A number of things have happened, and today contained two kind of curious events. But maybe the first thing I should say is we did talk, while I spoke, rather flippantly about backdoors last week and the US government's wish to have as many backdoors as they can for their intelligence services. And then, of course, after the show the next day, there was this ransomware that brought computers all around the world to a kind of standstill.
Yes, that was the one with the NSA cyber weapon incorporated in it. It was leaked a few weeks beforehand or some. No, actually, it was back in, well, a few months back, actually.
Yeah, the weapon was called External Blue.
Right.
And it got into the hand of this group called the Shadow Brokers. And they were auctioning off this tool to whoever wanted to buy it. And then, a few months later, supposedly, the security experts said they're surprised it took so long. But someone had basically used this tool and carved out this ransomware software called WannaCry. And so one of the things I was doing this week, like many, many people around the world, I still have a computer here that uses XP, was patching this computer. So that happened right after I was speaking very flippantly about backdoors. I felt kind of foolish after that.
Well, yeah, I know it had come out when I was looking at that story. It had come out that Microsoft had been complaining that various organisations, cyber companies and stuff, were basically hoarding patches and updates. And then it turned out that Microsoft was indeed hoarding patches. And the one they released to rectify this problem in old legacy versions of Windows, basically, they'd been sitting on since the 13th of February. But the reason they didn't release it was because they earn a lot of money out of customized support. So, yeah, $800 a computer. So imagine how much money the NHS is spending.
Yeah, that's big money, isn't it? Now, the other thing that happened was on a technical level for this show.
Okay.
As you may have noticed, I made myself a microphone pop filter and a microphone stand. So it was very Blue Peter, but I was doing that yesterday. Hopefully you can hear the difference tonight.
Yeah, it's the only thing. When you're holding a microphone for 2 hours, Jay, there will be a little bit of noise.
Yeah, so now very happy. As I say, the pop filter or the spit guard was made from something I found in the kitchen and some wire, and one of the wife's stockings was appropriated for the gauze. And then the milk bottle is a regular milk bottle. It's semi-skimmed. And I've made a cunning hole in the bottom and trailed the microphone cord from there. And then a counterweight of lots of shrapnel, loose change that was lying around the house. The overall ensemble is very pleasing, so I'm happy that it works well and it looks beautiful. I did put a picture of it up on the Twitter, but I've also, maybe I'll put it on the new Twitter that you're going to announce today.
Yeah. Right, okay. So just before we get into the bits and pieces, we've got a busy show today. So you can go to the usual place. Our website is bookarmor.com. That's bookarmor.com. And as Jay mentioned, we have a new Twitter account. So if you have anything you'd like to share with us, it's at InsideTrackDJ. And that's not because we're, you know, hedonistic DJs, dicks, jockeys. It stands for Dave and Jay. So, yeah, InsideTrackDJ. So please send us something and we'll give you a mention on air if you do. So then, Jay, what's the first topic up for discussion today?
Well, I believe we're going to start with the election news.
Election news. Okay. So, Theresa May, have you noticed, just to start the ball rolling, that this week she has been making an attempt, because it had become very apparent last week that she was staying out of the way of the general public by having these very kind of organised and managed events with highly selected people to attend. And she's been going out and about into the woods, man, into the jungle. What was your take on that?
Well, first of all, we have to assume that it's Theresa May. She may be using one of these things that in Iraq they call a fee day, where Saddam Hussein or these high-ranking officials employ a body double who goes out on their behalves in case there's an assassination attempt. So firstly, it might not be the real Theresa May. It could also be a robot. So I'm kind of agnostic on that. But OK, we'll give her her due and say it's the real Theresa May. It doesn't seem to be working too well, this policy of trying to engage the public, because the public, quite a few of them, are rather angry. So the week has been characterized by Theresa May basically having to, well, she does keep pulling that one face she's got, that kind of, she seems to find everything pretty much ghastly would be the word. So she keeps doing that face where her mouth slides off to the side. So she's been doing that a lot this week.
As my father used to say, a face chewing, looks like he's chewing a bumblebee.
Well, it does kind of worry me that her basic reaction to things that she doesn't understand or that don't fit with her rather narrow views of the world just seems to be outright disgust. That does kind of worry me.
Right. I was going to say, let's get the first clip out of the way. I did a little medley of, she was on LBC radio, and this was one of the first opportunities that the public has had to actually put questions directly to her. Let's have a listen and see what people generally think.
I've personally dedicated the last 12 years of my life to a career in medicine. I'm now at the point of seriously considering resignation because things have gotten so bad on the shop floor. What are you planning to do about these crippling frontline staff shortages, which have worsened as a result of the government's failure to invest properly in the NHS? You've reappointed as a health secretary someone who has demoralised the entire workforce of the NHS.
So she failed to negotiate a contract with the police force at a time as Home Secretary. And she failed to negotiate the deportation of six Algerian terror suspects. And her health secretary also failed to negotiate a contract with the doctors and again imposed it on them. What makes her think that she's the person to negotiate the Brexit deal?
You've already said that you want to reduce immigration in this country to the tens of thousands. In 2010, the Conservative Party pledged to do the same and didn't achieve it. And in 2015, they pledged to do it again and didn't achieve it. And you were the Home Secretary in charge of reducing those numbers. And now you say you're going to hit the tens of thousands target. How am I supposed to believe, after 6 or 7 years of failing to hit that target, that you're going to have any success this time?
So, yeah, not generally pleased, as you say, Jay.
A million, what would we say, like 6 million angry customers, something like that?
Yeah, well,
I'm not sure how many people work in the frontline public services, but as I say, it's a considerable number, and it does seem that the majority of them are not very happy.
Well, I remember seeing Jeremy Corbyn was doing, I think it was on Sunday, he was in front of some union for nurses, NHS union. Mm. And when he was explaining what he was going to do as part of his manifesto, though he wasn't, this was the day before the manifesto had come out, so he wasn't going to reveal too much. But just on what he had said, he got a standing ovation, basically, from everyone who was attending.
Yeah, Jeremy Corbyn, basically, with his message, he's not afraid to tread anywhere, basically, apart from perhaps at meetings of the Blairite faction of the Labour Party. But everywhere else, he's welcome. He might get a frosty reception at the CBI if he sticks his head around the door there. But for people just doing this, the people the Tories are so adamant that they care about, these, what do they call them? I can't remember even what they call them, the hardworking...
Oh,
people.
Yeah, that's it, the hard-working people.
Well, the Tory... Oh.
No, it's all right. I was going to say, she's been out and about a few times, and she's been... she was in Oxfordshire, and a woman had accosted her on the street who suffered with learning difficulties and was complaining about losing a lot of money, her PIP payments, personal independence payments. And she, what I found was interesting was when she was looking at Theresa May, she said, they have taken my money off of me. I cannot afford to live off £100 a month. When actually, the person who had taken it off of her was pretty much standing in front of her. So it was interesting that she was blaming someone else other than the person that was in front of her. I thought that was strange. So I'll play that. Let's have a quick listen to it.
Please, are you going to help people with learning disabilities?
I'm being serious. I want you to do something for us.
We've got a lot of plans for people with mental health.
And learning disabilities. Because I've got mild learning disabilities. Yes. And I haven't got a carer at the moment.
Right.
And I'm angry. And I would like somebody to help me because I can't do everything I want to do. I'm talking about everybody, not just me. I'm talking about for everybody who's got mental and anybody who's got learning disabilities. I want them not to have their money taken away from them and being crippled.
We're going to do a number of...
The fat cats keep the money and us lot get nothing.
Kathy, we're going to do a number of things. Let me just tell you...
She's right. She's right when she says the fat cats keep it all and everyone else gets stitched up.
It does say something, doesn't it, that even if you have learning disabilities and mild mental illness, that you can still see through these Tory policies. You don't need to be particularly clever to see what's going on. The people that vote Tories are basically, they're just voting for them because they're getting something out of it. But if everyone else, it's kind of obvious what's going on. So, yeah, you can see why that woman is angry. And £100 a month in Britain, that's definitely not enough for anyone to live on.
Well, I have a great clip from Chunky, which I'll play later, where Chunky Mark, that is, was the artist formerly known as Taxi Driver.
The artist Taxi Driver,
right. Where he talks about Damien Green going on some radio show and saying that that particular payment that that woman refers to is not for living off. You have to find other monies for that. The way that Chunky puts it is actually quite entertaining, so I'll let him do it justice later. But his point is, this Damien Green just expects people to be able to pull out money to live off out of nowhere. That's their attitude.
Well, we also saw this policy being announced where the Tories are going to give you the opportunity to take a year off work, although you'll still count as being employed, but you won't receive any money from your employer. So this very generous offer, isn't it, that you can take a year off work while still being counted as employed. Now, why would you like to take this year off work? Well, the Tories have had this sudden realization that because all these services are being cut, well, who is going to look after these people? So the idea is you take a year off work unpaid, you can't claim any benefits in the meantime, and you care for your dying relative or your dying spouse. And that is a Tory policy in their manifesto, which is supposed to attract people to vote for them. I think Jeremy Corbyn wrote the Conservative Party's manifesto.
Have you had a chance to see the... Because the Conservatives were releasing the manifesto just as I was leaving, coming to the studio. So have you had a chance to go through it at all? If you haven't, don't worry.
No, Dave, I have not busied myself today working my way, what would I say, wading through the Conservatives' latest pack of lies that they're intent on foisting on the British public. Craig Murray has a post up about it, and what he noted was it's something like 12 pages in before you see any figures related to spending, how much things might cost. And then throughout the document, there's almost nothing about where the money that they're saying they're going to spend is going to come from. And he's just making the point that the Liberal Democrats and particularly the Labour Party were torn apart by the newspapers and the media over their supposed inability to get their sums right or to say where the money is coming from. The chap was sitting on the sofa talking about the magic money tree and all that kind of stuff again. Whereas the Tories are very much given a free ride by the media. They don't have to play by the same rules that the others have to play with. They're not held to the same standard. And their manifesto, they know they're not going to be subject to too much scrutiny, so they can keep it nice and vague.
Well, So I had to give Corbyn some props the other day when he gate-crashed the interview with Mrs. Theresa May on Facebook Live with Robert Peston, who was actually hosting the 45-minute interview. And halfway through the show, he says, oh, we have a message from a Jeremy Corbyn from Islington. And the face you see of the bumblebee chewing exercise that we were talking about a moment ago. Let's have a listen, because this is so entertaining.
Now, perhaps surprisingly, I've got a question in from Jeremy Corbyn of Islington. He says, hello, Theresa May. As Prime Minister, you've served your elite friends by giving them tax cuts when wages have stagnated. House building is at its lowest since the 1920s. There are 20,000 fewer police on ours since 2010, and the NHS is in crisis. Do you not think the British people deserve to see he and you debate live and on television?
Well, what I think is more important is actually that I and he take questions directly from the voters. I don't think people get much out of seeing politicians sort of having a go at each other. I think people want to hear directly.
I don't think it's going to be a question of watching politicians have a go at each other. She'll probably come out with some insults. But generally speaking, I think it would be very informative to see how each's arguments and ideas for running the country match up together. What do you think, Jane?
Well, as someone who we did speak about this on the show before, and of course, I can't really see that there is a strong argument. Theresa May is also, you have to bear in mind that she continually is referring to herself as a strong leader. So
strong and stable.
How can you be a strong leader if you're not prepared to debate your direct political opponent? It doesn't strike me as strong at all. So she should either change the label on the tin, or she should basically make sure that the contents match. Jeremy Corbyn is right to keep hammering away at this and to keep embarrassing her. And as you rightly point out there, to characterise a leadership debate between two seasoned political figures in a Western democracy appearing on TV together, to characterise the likely encounter as being one where they simply have a go at each other, to me that just shows a tremendously low estimation of certainly of Jeremy Corbyn and of Theresa May herself. Is that really what it would amount to? But as you quite rightly point out, at the dispatch box, she does get away with it for 15 minutes on a Thursday because there's a kind of atmosphere around her, what would we say, a very kind of emotional and exaggerated atmosphere, and she has a gallery there to play to. If Jeremy Corbyn makes a good point, you can simply drown him out with lots of booing from your troops behind you. Deprived of that and forced to stand at a podium simply opposite Jeremy Corbyn, who we know from experience is a very dignified figure, he's simply going to put his hands behind his back like a Church of England vicar and hear her out. So it just can only be explained away as just simply an excuse, just running scared.
Well, he has a lot more of a relaxed demeanour in interviews. I know the BBC, the national BBC TV channels, have generally, put a slant on his performances, especially at Prime Minister's Question Time. And actually, what people have been completely captivated by is when they've gone out to hear him speak, He seems to be coming across differently to how he's coming across on the BBC. So he was recently up this neck of the woods, actually, just over the Pennines, about several miles down the road, in a place called Hebden Bridge, and he's also in Leeds. And thousands of people turned up. It was fantastic. There is a clip I'll play in a second, but did you get to see any of the coverage of how he was being received when he was going out and about around the country at all?
I did actually. The one that you mentioned in Hebden Bridge, his speech was scheduled for quite a small venue. It was indoors.
Yeah.
And what happened was, as you may know, he basically came outside and repeated his speech from a balcony for a waiting crowd who hadn't been able to attend the event proper. And I did watch a significant portion of that speech. And I watched the moment where he came out and saw everyone waiting there. And his performance was just so relaxed and assured. At the end of it, Jeremy Corbyn's simply not afraid of the British people in the same way that Theresa May is. So when he has that large crowd there, he really did have them, as they say, eating out of the palm of his hand, really. He was so relaxed and so assured. At one point, he said to them, "I've just come from the Royal College of Nurses conference in Liverpool." And the crowd didn't really react. And he said, you're supposed to cheer. And they all just, you know, went into a huge cheer for him. But no, there's momentum there for Jeremy Corbyn. And no one's paying those thousands of people to come and listen to him. Whereas Theresa May, there's this picture of her this week trying to make 12 people look like 12,000 with a camera angle in front of her lonely battle bus. It's chalk and cheese.
Yes, I saw that, actually, that picture you referred to this morning. And it's the glossy framing that the, you know, the mainstream media, would you call it? I suppose.
I think. On the meme that I saw, the top part is called the gloss, where, you say, you see the very tight shot, and it looks like a considerable number of people there. The bottom one is called reality, where you see that there's just a handful of people, and they're all crowded in very close. It's all smoke and mirrors. Now, what we might say here is that with Jeremy Corbyn's coverage, you know, the opposite is in effect. The reality is thousands and thousands of people. And the gloss that is applied is to make it look somehow as if it's insignificant, or to focus on some kind of trivial detail that emerges. Last week, it was, I think, just after the show finished, but there was this whole story where if you only listened to the BBC or Sky News, you would have believed that Jeremy Corbyn basically repeated the antics of that terrorist on Westminster Bridge and had driven a car over all kinds of people outside an event simply because a BBC cameraman's toe got squashed by a car that Jeremy Corbyn was a passenger in. The headlines made it sound as if he was at the wheel laughing, you know, in demonic fashion.
Well, you see, it's interesting you mentioned Sky and the BBC there in particular, because when he was up over in Yorkshire, in Leeds and Hebden Bridge, and the thousands of people. Now, BBC Yorkshire, the local TV, were there, and they seemed to paint it with a more of a realistic brush than you would expect from the national BBC News and Laura Kunzberg, who will basically appear later on.
Yes, big crowds turned out in Hebden Bridge and Leeds to see him today. Our political reporter James Vincent joined us from Leeds now. James, when Jeremy Corbyn was in the city last week, his reception was described as something of a pop star's welcome. How was it for him today?
Yeah, exactly right. If anybody tells you politics is boring, they weren't in Leeds this afternoon. There was a huge crowd here. He'd been in Hebden Bridge earlier in the day, and the crowds there were so big he had to do two speeches, one inside the venue and one outside the venue. The crowds in Leeds, there was a few thousand people here in Leeds this afternoon. A young population here, mainly student area, a lot of young people out on the streets. Really interesting to hear what he said. But just the amount of people on the streets, I've not heard that sort of reaction, that sort of chanting since I was down the road at Headingley watching England in the one day. Let's have a listen and a look at now his reception as he got off the battle bus here in Leeds.
The roof over there. Thank you for those up the tree over there.
It was amazing. People hanging onto lampposts, hanging onto trees. Thousands of people in the street here in Hyde Park to see him speak. Jeremy Corbyn seems to have that in Leeds at the moment, and he's making a trademark of these stump speeches, old school campaigning on the stump. It's something that Theresa May has not been doing a great deal of. Her events have been typified by her having a lot of party members around her, some factory workers as we saw last week, but not really big public events. I think there's more of this to come.
So that's probably got to be out there with one of the most genuine BBC reports about Corbyn I've heard.
We did talk about this together, didn't we? And we kind of came to the conclusion that at the local level, they kind of have a duty as well, or there's pressure there to be basically more honest. They know that the people watching on the TV, that many of them may have been at the actual event or know people who did attend, and to begin massaging the numbers or trying to characterize the reaction as something other than it was. can be kind of counterproductive. So at the local level, the BBC is capable of just the steady journalism that you'd hope for. Whereas, like you said, at the national level, they can begin to play games rather with how they frame things. The other thing I would say there is that if anyone climbs a tree to catch sight of Theresa May on the campaign trail, they'll probably have a telescopic rifle over their shoulder.
Well, I mean, as we heard on that, when he got off the battle bus, and I've isolated it, so let's have a quick listen. So there's that. And then when we compare that, so that's Corbyn turning up, getting out of a bus. This is a recording of Theresa May leaving one of her highly managed events. Yeah, we get the point.
That's pretty much what I come home from work each day with the wife.
Oh, dear. But that tells you everything, really. Now, I believe that footage was caught on someone's phone, whereas the other footage was actually on the BBC. So any negative stuff that you will maybe come into contact with won't, to do with Theresa May, won't be on the BBC or Sky, as you mentioned earlier on, Jay. It's through social media this stuff comes to light, which, as we will mention in a bit, with Facebook and stuff, that's quite pivotal in this election, it seems.
And, of course, its reach as a meme can be greatly circumscribed by Facebook. It might be going viral, but whether or not it's having the same kind of penetration as stuff that gets on the 6 o'clock news or the Channel 4 news or the late news is kind of doubtful, isn't it? And it's also deprived of the kind of framing that Kunzberg and the people at Sky can apply to these clips, so they can enhance the effect. And also, you know, they can simply stick them on repeat to make sure that everyone kind of gets their taste. One thing I did want to mention here is a story that's coming out on BuzzFeed about Sky News. And I think this kind of just highlights how autocratic this Theresa May campaign is. Because if you've seen this story, the senior political editors at Sky News are basically unhappy with the access they're being given to the Conservative campaign. And the Conservatives are trying to cut them off now and saying that they will prefer just to do interviews with Nick Robinson, Kunzberg and a couple of other BBC types. That is, to me, that's just extraordinary.
And what is their explanation for suggesting that this is to be the case? Why?
The explanation, Dave, is that Sky's questions are not sufficiently deferential to Theresa May and to senior Tory figures, and they're being punished for this.
Right. They're punished. So they want basically a media group to be all in with the Conservatives, and anything other than that is when they get ostracised out of the group.
Well, nothing journalists hate more than being placed in the out-group, right? on the naughty step. But Sky News are basically unhappy, and they're saying that we people at the heart of the Tory operation are... they've expressed their displeasure with Sky's political coverage. But Sky News stands by its journalism and is committed to fair, impartial and accurate reporting of all the political parties. I'm just quoting there from Sky News statement.
So was it Emily Formby was on the Andrew Marr show on BBC on Sunday, and she was talking to Michael Fallon, who's the Home Secretary, isn't he?
I think Michael Fallon is the Defence Secretary.
Ah, right, OK. So she basically told him his fortune.
Emily Thornberry, there's been a lot of attacks on your party's patriotism and so forth over the last few weeks. You've seen another story in the papers today about Jeremy Corbyn and the IRA. What's your message to those people who are patriotic, working-class voters, and they look at this stuff and they say, I just don't like it?
Well, I think that there were negotiations going on behind the scenes, and there were people speaking openly. And this is something which has been known for 30 years, and it's being dragged up at this particular time because there's a general election on. And I think
that's surprising.
And I think, well, yeah, but you know, I know. I mean, I think
the
question.
The risk.
No, I understand that. And I suppose if you judge people by who it is that you spend time with, the question has to be: do you remember where you were on the 27th of May 2007?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Yes, I am. So you were in Syria, and you were celebrating at a reception the re-election of President Assad with a 99% percentage of the vote. Now, I'm not going to judge you on you going to a reception with Assad, and I don't think that people should judge Jeremy by trying to talk to people who might be open to a settlement in Northern Ireland.
Is this true?
There was a parliamentary visit. I was on a parliamentary all-party visit to Syria. Back in 2007, MPs have gone every year to Syria during the better times in the relationship between Syria and Britain.
But you were at the party, weren't you?
I don't recall any party in Syria. I remember a fact-finding visit to Syria. That happened every year with MPs going out there.
Did you meet Assad when you were there?
I did meet Assad, indeed.
Shake his hand?
Indeed, I met
Assad.
And
you celebrated his re-election?
10 years. I didn't celebrate
his re-election. Well, that was what the reception was for. It was for celebrating his re-election.
Nonsense. 10 years ago, we had a different relationship with Assad here. But there's a huge moral difference between talking to other foreign leaders, and I meet them all the time as Defence Secretary, and Jeremy Corbyn's quite open support for the IRA, which was actually engaged in Northern Ireland.
Open support for the IRA. You really can't just go around making this stuff up. There's an election on, and people need to make decisions on the basis of the truth.
Parliament.
You've just said, for example, that I want to negotiate the future of the Falklands. That is... I did
that
not.
Just say again, come on.
It's untrue.
It's not often I hear someone basically say it as it is, especially to someone as high up as Michael Fallon.
Yeah, fair play to Emily Thornberry there, and she dropped in the bollocks as well. So just take the guy, just take the guy by his tie and just wipe the floor with him. And what I enjoyed there was when... Ma was making the point about something Jeremy Corbyn did 30 years ago. Michael Fallon seemed to think that 10 years ago was longer than 30 years ago, with the way his indignation, that it was 10 years ago. So I don't know what kind of calendar Michael Fallon operates. I'm glad that she did that. This IRA thing that gets brought up every now and again about Jeremy Corbyn, it really is one of those "are you still beating your wife" kind of tropes. And Andrew Marr, you know, it's just kind of shameless, isn't it, to keep putting it there, basically to trigger his audience, to trigger all those old dears watching at home. The IRA. You know, I don't know why they don't just make a big explosion kind of sound effect that they can play at the same time and people screaming.
Yeah, they need to take a leaf out of Fox News. and a bit of... production value.
Do they really do that on Fox News? That's a great idea.
Oh yeah, whenever they have like a news alert, it's like
it's like Pavlovian training, isn't it? That every time you ring the bell, the dogs will start salivating because their dinner's coming. Every time they say Jeremy Corbyn, you have to slip IRA on the end so the people at home can shake their fists there for the 2 minute hate.
well, we'll be getting onto that 2 minute hate at some point. So. Is that the current political news covered? Is there anything else we need?
Well, the only thing I would have said was I wanted to talk just for a second about the Guardian's coverage this week and also about the Corbyn campaign. So the first thing I did notice, I am a Guardian reader. You too, Dave, but perhaps me more. I do fit like the profile of a Guardian reader, apart from the income level, but everything else fits. So it is the first place I go for news. Now, the Guardian has been the most critical of Jeremy Corbyn of any of the newspapers over the last 18 months since he became leader, basically. And what's happened in the last week is that suddenly, since the manifesto leak, the Guardian has run a succession of more pro-Labour stories, maybe more pro-Labour stories in 1 week than the whole of the last year. And I'm just kind of curious about the reason for this. Now, you did supply part of the what may be an explanation for this change of heart by The Guardian. And my reading is that they're beginning to hedge, because what they're concerned about is that Jeremy Corbyn may outperform Ed Miliband at the 2015 election. And The Guardian is already beginning to wonder how to deal with that narrative and with that kind of awkward fact. So I think this may be why they've started to hedge and run some more positive stories about Jeremy Corbyn. And that is linked with the fact that his campaign does genuinely seem to be gaining momentum, and that the polling numbers now, I believe you said that they're above the level that Ed Miliband was at when we went into the last general election.
Yeah, the main political pundit off of Sky News was giving him an interview the other day, and was basically, he kept referring back to Ed Miliband and trying to compare all the time. And I was kind of wondering why that was the case. And so when you then mentioned the idea that, he seems to be rivaling even, get my teeth in today, any past experience that anyone has with any past leader of the Labour Party. And some people, it rattles some people's cages. They're like, you know, especially the mainstream media, that they, you know, we know what they're like and how they treat it. So any detrimental stuff they can throw at him and hope some of it sticks, that's what they do, isn't it?
Yeah, and the last thought that came out of our discussion this week was that I did make the point that although I don't believe Jeremy Corbyn is a very good leader of the Labour Party, in terms of the parliamentary Labour Party, I actually do believe that he could be a good leader of the country. And I think the campaign is starting to show that, because he's performing far better when he's out on the streets of Britain than he ever does inside Westminster. And that's really coming through loud and clear. And I think that is why excitement is beginning to build. And there's all kinds of strange things going on now. He's turned into a meme. He's kind of seen as being kind of so uncool that he's kind of cool. Because he's rather relaxed, actually, a lot of young people seem to be like getting on his side now. And this, I don't really know this musical movement, but it's called grime. Do you know this music?
I've heard of the name. I can't say I'm a fan of it, but
I think it's kind of black urban music mostly. But some of these grime artists who are very high profile, they can certainly reach people that don't usually vote and certainly don't tune into the politics shows. They're beginning to get on side for Corbyn, and they've done kind of Instagram things, and they've had their photos taken with him, and now they're talking of doing some kind of concert called Grime for Corbyn. There's a website they've set up that's made all kinds of cool montages of Jeremy Corbyn. It really is laugh out loud funny. If people check it out, I'll place it on the Book Armour website. So certainly in this last week, we know that the media has more information than we do. They're privy to more data, and there does seem to be something happening the last week.
Well, I know when he was in Leeds, and obviously Leeds, young population, as you heard on that report from BBC Yorkshire, kind of student population. So when he turned around to the waiting masses of thousands of people and said that he's going to get rid of tuition fees for university students, he's going to get rid of 0 hours contracts and raise the minimum wage to the living wage of £10. What student isn't going to jump all over that? I mean, that's fantastic.
Yes, and let's see what happens in the next week. Perhaps we're going to see some pushback, and they'll try and derail his campaign with some scandals in the next week. So maybe we just prepare ourselves for that.
Yeah, that it's something. They ain't going to let this carry on, I think, up until the election in this sense, because Theresa May's not coming out at all well out of this, you know. So, shall we move on to the next subject, yeah?
Yes, please.
So, undercover cops. Now, I'm not too familiar with this. What I do remember from this was when it first broke out, people were appalled because they were using dead children's names as cover identities. So, what do you reckon? Shall I ask you some questions about it, Jay?
I think that would be a great idea.
Okay. So, question one then. When did it begin? And why was it set up, this undercover? Is it a particular group? How's it set up?
Okay, so let's take the first thing. When did it begin? Now, this kind of undercover policing began in 1968.
Wow. That long?
Yeah, that long ago. Now, of course, 1968 was a very tumultuous year across the world. It's synonymous with global uprisings, the likes of which we haven't really seen since, despite things like the Occupy movement and the poll tax riots. But 1968 was a pivotal year. And something happened during the anti-Vietnam protests in London, in Grosvenor Square, which you may actually know Grosvenor Square. And the US embassy was sited there at the time. I'm not sure if it's still there. But a protest got out of hand, and a considerable number of people stormed the US embassy compound, and they got inside. And basically, the police were completely blindsided by this and were very embarrassed that this had happened. And basically, the call went out from government, how do we stop this happening again?
Right. So, that's why it was set up, to basically manage PR for the police.
To maintain public order is what the police would say.
Right.
And in order to do that, a man stepped forward. You know, they say, cometh the hour, cometh the man.
Yeah, yeah.
In this case, the man was called Conrad Heath Dixon. And he was a special branch officer. And he approached the government with his kind of back of a fag packet plan, and supposedly said, give me £1 million and 10 men and I'll sort your problem. Although these days it sounds like the kind of thing a pop star might say, give me £1 million, 10 men and a big bag of drugs and I'll have a hell of a party.
Yeah.
So they gave him his £1 million and his 10 men, and he set up this unit inside Special Branch. Now, I'm not someone who's deeply engaged with policing matters. So I did kind of check out how it works. Now, the way it works is that the Metropolitan Police Special Branch is a unit of the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah.
And then the SDS, the Special Demonstration Squad, was a unit inside the Special Branch. And it only selected officers who had already, joined Special Branch, who were considered the cream of the police force. So he had his 10 men at the start. And they decided to do, his proposal was this kind of undercover work.
So is it the SDS, the ones that are responsible for looking after diplomats, politicians? They're the ones that you would see standing out the front of Downing Street, for instance? Guns?
No.
Right, okay.
No, they're not uniformed officers. Now, before the SDS was set up, had the police engaged in other undercover work before? Well, yes. But the new proposal from Dixon was completely different in degree, because beforehand the police used to kind of pose maybe for a week or 2 weeks as a drug dealer or an antiques dealer, something like this. And they would have an operation and then they would hook, their suspects and then prosecute them. What Dixon proposed was completely different. Under his plan, officers would live out their undercover identities for years at a time, and they would constantly be feeding back intelligence to their handlers, and the intelligence they supplied would not be used in trials. It would not be presented in a court of law. So basically no one would know that they were in place, and no one would know that they were passing this intelligence to their superiors at the police force. That was his wheeze.
Have you ever been under surveillance, Jane?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer. Have I met Special Branch officers? Yes, I believe so, on one occasion.
I was surveilled once for 3 weeks when I lived in Bedsit Land in South London many years ago. Nothing came of it, but it was interesting, yeah. So, if this has been going on since 1968, and I mean, when you mention that guy, Dixon, I just think of Dixon of Doc Green.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that, but this is more like Dixon of the Stasi.
Right. Yeah. We've just got Alan in the studio. I think he would like to ask you a question, Jay.
Yeah, okay, Jay. There's actually a really good book on this that I've purchased. I think you have to send for it from the Guardian sort of bookshop. And read that, and a couple of the officers there were on undercover for so long that they actually bred with some of actually had children.
Yeah.
And neither case did they tell the ladies they were involved with that they were undercover coppers. So there's a women's group that come together and they're actually trying to get them private prosecution for statutory rape for this. And one of the officers, can't remember his name, but he was actually involved with the animal rights group. And he went as far and is alleged to have actually started some fires in a major firebomb, a major department store, to help hide his cover. Yeah. And it was the whole thing was instigated by this guy.
You know, the interesting thing about what – it's Alan, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
The interesting thing there about what Alan's just said is he's just spoiled the next 10 minutes of the show.
Sorry.
Well, I was going to ask.
Hey, look, I've hit myself.
What?
No, it's okay, Alan.
Self-flagellation,
the
mate.
The book that Alan mentioned there is called Undercover.
Yeah, I've got it, yeah.
So when was
Rob Evans and Paul Lewis. Now, the gentleman who fathered the child is Bob Lambert, and Bob Lambert is also the gentleman who allegedly or very probably set off an incendiary device in a Debenhams warehouse that caused millions of pounds worth of damage. So Bob Lambert then went on to appear as under his own – he used a pseudonym, he used his alias when he was undercover. But with his real name, Bob Lambert, he became a professor at St. Andrews University and reinvented himself as a kind of counter-terrorism expert. I think he's since been finally, after years of campaigning, chased from that particular job. And as Alan rightly said, the women have set up a campaign. There's a number of groups, but the main one is called – well, the main two are campaign Police Spies Out of Lives and the campaign opposing police surveillance. And I've got links to them on Book Armour. But yes, the women have agreed settlements with the Metropolitan Police and they were apologised to. But as Alan said, they basically feel that they've been in – they said literally kind of raped by the state.
So when was the first undercover cop's identity revealed then to the general public and this all came out?
Now, is Alan going to answer that or am I?
Can I just add a very quick thing that I'll butt out before I ruin your whole show? Just so that there are quite a few of these women who have had children with these undercover police. And there's a few that come out and there's another famous book on it that's by a guy who was an undercover football hooligan and pretended he supported Millwall for 2 years. And then they actually found out his identity and it sent him a bit crazy. So this guy was from a different – he's written a book. I've got that – got it out of the library, read that. And there's quite a few different groups of police that have done this. It's not just kind of the main ones that kind of were discovered. But some of the women, as far as I know, have actually refused – an apology and a going ahead, because it's not for them a matter of money. It's a matter of getting in court and questioning these guys. And for some of them, I know the battle's still going on.
Right. Now, I don't know about that football hooligans book. That'd be very interesting.
Yeah,
to
it was
see
actually
that.
Made into a film. It's going about 10 years about Millwall.
That sounds familiar.
I'm trying to think of the name. No. It was.
No, that was the Jonathan King book, wasn't it? But that was excellent too.
But this is the guy was actually – I mean, I saw the film and read his autobiography of it, and the autobiography was quite poignant because you could hear this guy going gradually raving bonkers as he was supporting Mill. And he ended up leaving the police force and being really upset, almost a depression, that he could no longer go along and support Mill.
Well, the two gentlemen mentioned in Undercover that went crazy. The first case study is a guy called Chitty, who went crazy during the early days of the unit. And like you said, he kind of got kind of sucked into his cover story and started living it out, a completely different personality to the one that he'd had before. And the other person who kind of went rogue, although not to the same extreme as Chitty, who his handlers worried was suicidal, was actually the first spy cop to be revealed. And that was the Mark Kennedy, whose alias was Mark Stone. He was taken out by his handlers. Basically, he couldn't really live without the scene that he'd been a part of, and he found private employment with a firm doing similar kind of work. And basically, Mark Stone rode again, and the Metropolitan Police Special Branch were obliged to place him under surveillance themselves then.
Surveilling the surveyors. That's...
Because the thing with him, the Kennedy, is that he was married with a family, and then he started another family that the first family didn't know about to keep his cover going, and he ended up going completely barking mad and going off to living in Ireland, I think.
Actually, he didn't have a second family, Alan.
Didn't he?
But he did have like a number of relationships, and what happened was when he went back, once he'd gone rogue, the Metropolitan. He was not actually working for the SDS. He was part of this other unit called the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, which ran alongside the SDS for a while. So what happened was they took him back in and they took away all of his fake documentation. So when he went back into the field as Mark Stone, this time he was carrying around, he was using his own passport. And so he went on a trip out of the country with this woman he was in a deceitful relationship with. And while she was fiddling around in the glove compartment, she happened upon a passport which had a different name to the one she was familiar with. And that set off her alarm bells and she began checking into it. And this culminated in the discovery of documentation that confirmed that at the time he got married, Mark Kennedy listed on the marriage certificate that his occupation was that of a policeman. The marriage had taken place in Ireland because his wife was an Irish citizen, and that was one of the reasons why the information was so difficult to obtain. Very interestingly, the activist came into possession of the phone number of the house in Ireland, and Kennedy had disappeared for a while, so they came up with the idea of calling and asking to speak to his son, Jack. When they called, the activist said, "Is Jack there, please?" And a man's voice said, "No, he isn't. It was Mark Kennedy on the phone." So then they knew.
Amazing, man, amazing.
So we was going to...
Now, the question we should ask here, and Alan hasn't posed it yet, is why were they going to all this trouble? What were they trying to combat? What kind of definitions did they have of persons of interest? Now, of course, if you listen to the Theresa May version, then we'd think that they were all at the beginning, that they were all necessarily like perhaps Irish terrorists. And then later you might think that they were, Muslim terrorists. But actually, it's much more mundane than that. And the SDS worked on a definition of subversion.
Could I just to add one more thing? There's actually come out since that there were three or four women who did it the other way round in this. I think that's important to add.
Well, women, yes, there officers, are some women that did it. The one who's been unmasked is called Lynn Watson, who used to operate in Leeds. Now, at the start, the SDS was focused on the anti-war movement, and then they became interested in the anti-apartheid struggle. So this is probably where they first became interested in Jeremy Corbyn, who we do know has a large file with this unit. And the reason that women began to be sent into the field was during the 1980s, and that was because they wished to infiltrate the environmental movement, and they also wished to infiltrate the protests at Greenham Common, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which was, of course, basically 100% women. So that's when they began to use women.
That's the one with Swampy, wasn't it?
No, Swampy was the Newbury bypass, but they also worked on that kind of campaign too. But we must make the distinction here, which is the SDS was concerned with subversion. So the original kind of definition there is very close to the kind of MI5 definition, which was anyone who threatens the safety or well-being of the state and are intended to undermine or overthrow parliamentary democracy by political, industrial or violent means. That is absolutely MI5's mission. And, Special Branch is often referred to as the arresting arm of MI5 or the intelligence services. So that was subversion. Now, the unit that Mark Kennedy belonged to was this NPOIU. And now they were focused on a different thing. And what they came up with, and this is under Jack Straw and New Labour, so it's not to do with it's not necessarily a conservative thing. And they came up with this domestic extremism definition.
Oh, yeah.
So this is like the more modern incarnation. And this one was basically people that want to prevent something from happening or to change legislation or domestic policy, often doing so outside of the normal democratic process. That actually doesn't sound too dangerous. And now, over time, it's expanded. And what they say now is that domestic extremists include, listen to this, campaigners against war, nuclear weapons, racism, genetically modified crops, globalization, tax evasion, airport expansion and asylum law, as well as those calling for reforms of prison and peace in the Middle East. So all of those things, all of those causes are sufficient, just one of them, to have you branded a domestic extremist, regardless of whether you've actually broken any laws in the during your activism.
Yeah, in the 1980s, I was very, very active in the Labour Party in my hometown. I was very active campaigning in the miners' strike and in other left-wing organisations. And I was with someone at the time, had a relationship, and then I met someone else who had a relationship with, and I don't know, but found out that her great-uncle had been a founder of MI5, so we'll never know. But, yeah, interesting stuff.
You've been
well,
novel.
I hope you never found yourself in bed with one of these undercovers, Alan.
The kid is 30.
That's your answer to that, Christian.
He sat on my knee. Actually, if I had the child that was the coppers, the undercover copper was the father, I would send the child to school in police uniform.
you've confused us there, man.
I would simply dress my child in a policeman's uniform and make them walk around outside all day.
It's not the child's fault, is it?
Talk about a red-headed stepchild. I don't think you could imagine a child that you'd want less.
A ginger policeman.
And if you've seen Mark Kennedy, he has the eyes that look in both directions, so you certainly wouldn't want him taken after the fight.
Oh, he can see round corners before he gets there.
He genuinely can see round corners.
There's a skill we could all do with.
Oh, to come back, dicks in a duck groin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you had the communards lined up. What was the explanation for this?
I did, because the reason we talk about the spy cops on tonight's show, and I'm sorry I made a few kind of crass jokes there, but the reason we're talking about it is because the latest undercover has just had his identity revealed. Up to now, there's a group, Adam might know this, it's called Undercover Research Group, and they're compiling profiles on these spy cops, and basically they've unmasked 14 so wow. far, and they have 5 more to follow. Now, we know that the unit, the SDS, generally had 10 undercovers at any one time, and it was running until 2000 and I think to the end of the 2000s. So over the course of 40 years, with 10 in the field, and maybe they were doing kind of tours of about 3 to 6 years. So it's a considerable number of officers to trace. And then this other unit that Mark Stone belonged to also had a considerable number of undercovers. So it's really a tiny figure so far, but they're doing great work on revealing them. So the latest one was revealed seemingly completely by accident, but there is a link there to the pop group, the Communards. I don't know if you're a fan or not.
Don't leave me this way.
Well, funny enough, you say that, Al, like it was organised. If he takes his time starting, that'll be my fault for
him. Something's going to happen.
As if by magic, it appears. Yeah, I didn't edit the beginning of that one, obviously, as you can tell. So, Gannon, explain to us, Jay.
The link with the Communards is that this is not Jimmy Somerville link. This is the chap that played the keyboards, who's called Richard Coles. And he's a really very, very interesting person. After he did the Communards, he had a radio show that was superb. And then he retrained as an Anglican vicar. So now he's the Reverend Richard Coles. So he's quite a good writer. So a few years ago, he published the first part of his he published the first part of his biography. And in that, he mentions in just a sentence or so that his brother would sometimes come home looking kind of like Wurzel Gummidge, who, just in passing, did pass away last week. So rest in peace, Wurzel Gummidge. But Andy Coles would come home, and what his job was infiltrating environmental campaigners. Now, that biography lay around, and not much, the link wasn't made until someone read it and then passed it to the undercover research group. And by looking into this, they determined after considerable investigation that Andy Coles, Richard Coles' brother, was this Andy Van, was his alias, but he was an undercover and he'd been working in the environmental movement. And now, as soon as that kind of broke, one of the a woman stepped forward to point out or to make known that she'd been in a relationship with Andy Coles, and she had basically been deceived into a sexual relationship with him. And at the time, she was only 19, and Andy Coles was considerably older, although he lied about his age too. So I don't know if you want to pick up the story, but Andy Coles by then had emerged again. He was using his own name, and he'd become a deputy police commissioner, and he was also a Tory councillor. I'm not sure in which part of the country, actually. I think it's in Cambridgeshire.
Yeah, he'd become one of these police commissioners. You know, they made a big song and dance about it, that the various areas were going to get their own police commissioner. And people were wondering, actually, what would be the point of these people. But it turned out that this guy had become one of these top-ranking police commissioners. So he would be local. He'd be responsible for the local, if it was Cambridgeshire, the Cambridgeshire Police Force, and liaison between the force and the general public. Well, obviously, when this came out, and there was a woman, I believe her name was Andrea.
Now, it's Jessica, actually.
Is it Jessica? So where was the Andrea thing from then?
That was a mistake on my part. I do apologise.
Ah, right. That would be why I couldn't find it then. Right? But this woman had just recently come out and said that she'd had a relationship with this guy back in the early 90s. And obviously, with the position he was now holding, so when this came to light, it kind of made his current position untenable. So he's handed in his resignation. And so he's no longer a police commissioner anymore.
The other thing we might mention there is the Don't Leave Me This Way, the message of that song there about this kind of anguish someone's going to feel if their love leaves them, is it does have a bearing on this story, because when these undercover cops would finish their kind of tour of duty, or when their handlers thought, you know, that maybe they'd exhausted the amount of intelligence they could provide, or they were beginning to show signs of wear and tear, they would have the undercover, if they were in a relationship, basically fake some kind of breakdown, some kind of episode that would enable them to suddenly simply disappear. So this Don't Leave Me This Way, often these undercovers compounded their deceit by leaving in very kind of traumatic or mysterious ways, just suddenly disappearing, often saying that they were going to Australia or going to some other kind of far-flung part of the world, coming up with a cock and bull story. But of course, that would be doubly devastating for these women that were basically, from their point of view, involved in real meaningful relationships. Mark Kennedy, the first woman that he had the sexual relationship with, I believe her name was might have been Lily. You know, if you read the undercover book that Alan mentioned, he was sitting on the sofa in her parents' house. He was going to the grandmother's 70th birthday party. You know, he was deeply, deeply involved in the lives of this family, and all of it was fake. All of it was just simply the relationships were basically just a means to an end to provide the intelligence for his handlers. Mark Stone said, "The police are trying to wash their hands of me." Mark Kennedy said, sorry. "The police are trying to wash their hands of what I did." But he said they had every text message, every email, every phone call I made. They knew what I was doing. They knew the relationships I was having. They said nothing.
No, well, it would help his cover story out. So if the powers that be, his bosses, were looking at just obtaining information, then how the individual agents go about, you know, acquiring that information is probably they wash their hands of it, unless, like now, they're going to have to deal with the fallout that was caused from it.
It still appears to be a moot point whether or not these undercovers are allowed to have sex with the the people they're spying on. It seems to be that, although it's not encouraged, there's nothing there to actually say that they can't if it happens. As you say about will it come out, the undercover book makes the point that in British life, whenever there's a major scandal like this, the way to kind of sweep it into the long grass is just simply to announce lots of inquiries. This is the preferred means. And actually, the spy cops have got something like 14 inquiries were launched. And the biggest one is still trying to get underway. And that is the Operation Pitchford. The Pitchford inquiry. The link to that is on Book Armour. But they're trying to go through and kind of penetrate what was going on. The Operation Hearn was an inquiry, and that looked at the issue that you started off the segment with, which was this appropriation of the identities of dead children, which was used by the SDS. It wasn't used by Mark Kennedy. But in those days, yes, they would find a dead child that had was born around the same day as themselves, and then they would pick up and have documents issued in their name. Obviously very troubling for the parents of those children.
So you may have answered this already, but what's the difference between SDS and this MPOIU?
Well, the difference was more, like I said, the kind of people they were going to place under surveillance. The SDS, being a part of the Metropolitan Police, it predominantly operated within London. And the other unit, the MPOIU, they were operating basically in everywhere else in England and Wales. So that would be the difference. And as I pointed out, they began to look at kinds of different kinds of supposed, in their words, domestic extremists. There's people on their database, it was revealed, who've never broken a law of the UK in their entire lives. There was one chap, they realised that the reason he'd been branded a domestic extremist was he had opposed some plan by a factory to fill in a lake near his house. And he'd been active in the local campaign against that. Because of that, he was labelled a domestic extremist. He wasn't particularly happy about that. We must make the point that Mark Kennedy himself said this was absolutely a sledgehammer to crack a nut in terms of what was going on.
So, but actually, go for it, Alan.
Okay, it's a very small point. In the middle of the miners' strike in 1985... even though I've only ever been a member of the Labour Party, did go along to a SWP summer camp, and there was only about 2,000 people there, and as far as we can see, I think all those people at some time have been surveyed, which is, I suppose, hardly surprising, but just thought I'd add that.
Was these groups, Jay, were these responsible for, was it the 70s and 80s, where people were blacklisted in certain industries?
I was going to pick up on that, and there's just two points. Would be one, like Alan said, undoubtedly there'll be lots of these people will have been either gathering intelligence, they'll have been police officers themselves, or they will have been under surveillance. Now, there is another book that's been written. Alan might know something about this. He might have encountered some of this issue, which is called Blacklisted. And
yeah,
what this
well.
Looked
yeah.
at was the blacklisting within the construction industry, which the industry denied for many, many years. And the police link to the blacklisting, which was actually run through a private organization called the Consulting Association, which was basically one man with lots of filing cabinets hidden at the back of his house. Now, what he would do is if a construction company, he would have them on a contract. Any new employees could be screened against this database. And basically, the database, the blacklist, was union members, people that had spoken out about health and safety issues, this kind of basically, activists or people, concerned individuals within the construction trade. There'd always been rumors within the construction industry that blacklists were being applied. It'd always been denied. Now, the police link to the Consulting Association is where did all the Consulting Association's information come from? The belief is that police officers, either officially or unofficially, were pouring information into this project as well. It was finally broken up, I believe, a matter of years ago. And it's only recently that the major construction firms like McAlpine have reached a settlement with members, people that work in this industry who were blacklisted. Now, for people who maybe don't know too much about this story, One link to this would be, and Alan will definitely know this story, this is a very famous story, is the actor Ricky Tomlinson and the way he was stitched up. I think they're called the Shrewsbury, and then they have a number like the Shrewsbury 3, something like this. These were basically activists in the construction industry who were fitted up by the police and in a show trial. And Ricky Tomlinson, the guy who appeared in The Royal Family, the actor, still busy trying to clear his name and receive an apology all these years on.
Well, he was on a few weeks ago. Oh, sorry. He was on RT a few weeks ago because he can't find any other outlet for his story. But we've got a vague contact, so we'll try and get him on here at some stage.
Well, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? Now, the other one there. So, yes, there may have been a link to the blacklist in the construction industry. Now, the other one that I didn't mention in terms of the extreme kind of behavior that these undercovers got up to is the discrediting of the Lawrence family, the family of Stephen Lawrence.
Yeah, that was big news, actually, when that came out, didn't it?
Now, there's two parts to this, which was the first part was the Metropolitan Police,
Before you give a little bit of background on the Lawrence case, just in case don't know.
Okay, so Stephen Lawrence was a black teenager who was killed at a bus stop in 1993 by a gang of white youths, and he was stabbed to death. And for a long time, no one was charged. And later, what emerged, and I know Alan is there, he probably doesn't like the Daily Mail very much, but one thing that has
they
to be
a
said,
lot of
when
campaigning
it comes to the
him,
case
agree,
of the
agree,
Stephen Lawrence
yeah.
murder, the Daily Mail was instrumental in bringing to justice the people that murdered Stephen Lawrence.
Yeah, right.
Now what happened was pressure began to grow on this botched police investigation, and the Metropolitan Police Service began to use the undercovers to basically shield themselves or to find out what kinds of criticisms would emerge. That was one part, it's kind of counterintelligence. The other part was they were very unhappy. The undercover book points out that when they looked into Stephen Lawrence's background, they were kind of furious because they said, this guy is like a white kid. This boy's never been in trouble.
Yeah.
He wanted to be an architect, and there was nothing, they couldn't smear him. And they were intent on smearing the campaign because they basically just did not want to be held to account for all the failures in their investigation. And also, they just don't want any kind of justice, basically.
And they also, smeared that friend of his who was... they kind of had him in court for a few things, didn't they?
They did. Now, the friend is Dwayne Brooks.
That's it. Yeah.
And he was with Stephen when he was murdered. And Dwayne Brooks was later charged, and... We do talk about the CPS quite a lot on this show for the way their decisions are made. And in the case of Dwayne Brooks, he was kind of adamant that the CPS was just hungry to find anything at all and to launch a prosecution against him. Now, what happened was the BMP, in true rabble-rousing form, they basically got themselves involved in kind of trying to attack the Lawrence family or use this kind of social unrest for their own ends. So what I believe happened was Dwayne Brooks attended some kind of counter protest against BMP, and he was caught at the scene on some footage, supposedly waving a stick or having a metal bar or something like this. So from that video footage, which the Metropolitan Police, you know, they may have had Dwayne Brooks under surveillance, but they're certainly out to find him, you know, the classic case of if they can find you with a faulty indicator on your car, whatever it is. So they got him with this prosecution, and they did manage to kind of smear the Lawrence family via that method. Now, the second part is that the McPherson inquiry was then launched years later. Now, it was a public inquiry to determine the failures of the Lawrence investigation, and it very famously concluded that the Metropolitan Police Service was guilty of institutional racism. Now, the link there with the undercovers is that the Metropolitan Police Service never made the inquiry aware of this intelligence gathering operation that they'd run against the Lawrence family. So the McPherson inquiry was completely in the dark there. So the police misled this public inquiry. So that is also a very salient fact. And that does tie in with another detail I wish to mention, which was you might say, who in Parliament or who in the government was overseeing all of this police spying? Who was overseeing all the activities of the SDS, for example? And the actual astonishing answer to that question is that the police never informed Parliament of what the SDS was doing.
So what, were they doing it off their own backs then?
The MPOIU, that was different because that was set up and that was bankrolled by the Home Office under Jack Straw. So a minister there knew what was going on in terms of the domestic extremism. But in the case of the SDS, it proceeded for years without any knowledge on the part of parliamentarians that it was even operating. Because, to go back to Conrad Dixon's kind of vision at the start of this, basically, if you only ever fed back intelligence and it was never used in trials, and you were never had a single one of your undercovers had their cover blown, well, then who would ever know? And basically, it's a bit like, what do they say in The Usual Suspects? The greatest trick the devil ever played was to convince people he didn't exist. You know, who would ever believe that the police were installing undercovers inside these groups for literally years at a time? It was just, it would be dismissed as, you know, David Cameron was very keen to dismiss anything at all as a conspiracy theory. And it would be something that would be very easily waved away given the complete lack of evidence.
That, and is it still going on? Is it still active?
The MPOIU is still active, yes. We should mention at the same time that this was only one little part of Special Branch, the undercovers. They've got this other part of their operation, something like 1,500 people, who basically do all the above board stuff of collecting information on people. So they basically, as Alan probably knows, they're probably going through the Word newspaper, underlining the name of every activist they can find.
I would take it as a badge of honour, my friend.
Compiling files on people. That's just to mention,
there's also a network of low-level police informers, you know, ne'er-do-wells who might have broken some law or, you know, usually drug dealers who they use as well.
Ne'er-do-wells?
Ne'er-do-wells.
Ruffians?
Oh, absolute bounders!
Hooligans?
Terrible people.
I like that
phrase, ne'er-do-wells.
It stopped me swearing, that was what I said. I was going to go somewhere else with that.
Some of the recruitment efforts, there's been some, The Guardian has carried some of the stories. For example, university students have been offered help, financial assistance with their paying their way through university if they're prepared to inform on groups that they belong to.
Wow. Yeah,
so the Guardian caught a policeman. The student had the good sense to make an audio recording of this pitch. And then, as Alan also said, a lot of students, of course, it's a rite of passage or it's way of life is to smoke marijuana or to ingest illicit substance, and the police will catch you on one of these little offences, and they'll say, "Look, you're a young man, you're a young woman. It'd be a terrible shame, you know, if you threw your future away. You know, if only we could think of something that we could, you know, that you could do for us. There'd be money in it." And, you know, they give them £50 or £100 a time. Some people have come forward who've been on those kinds of informal arrangements with the police, that they give you a little bit of money each time. But, of course, the police are the police. And when you outlast your usefulness, don't be surprised if the next time you get caught with a bag of weed, you know, the brother officer put it there, and then you're off to the big house.
Yeah, well... So, generally speaking, it's all this undercover spy work to obtain information, right? Which takes us quite smoothly on to the next subject of social media. Facebook in particular, taking on what we've been discussing on and off on this show, which is fake news. Let's have a listen.
The world's most used social media site is combating fake news with a warning label. Facebook says questionable stories assessed by third-party fact-checkers will be accompanied by a disputed tag. Flagged fake news on Facebook will also include a link to the source countering the article's claims. The company says it's working with ABC News, PolitiFact, FactCheck, and other media outlets to verify stories. Facebook is also giving users the ability to manually report fake news posts by clicking on a gray button on the right side of the article. While Facebook's moves are seen as a welcome step, there are caveats. After a bogus story is noticed by the network's software or reported by users, it can take several additional days before the article is assessed by fact-checking organizations. At least two have to agree before the disputed label is applied. Critics say by the time the lengthy process is complete, a bogus story could have been widely disseminated.
Right, so fact checkers. And I wonder who these fact checkers could be. What do you say, Jay?
Well, this was a Jason Kennedy special investigation, wasn't it? Because I kind of unearthed these fact checkers and did the research here. I don't know if Alan's familiar with the whole concept that's being applied here, but I can put some.
Yeah, we've been hit by it in our groups.
Well, so it's Defiant Radio. They've had their site taken down as well. So, yeah, sorry, Jay, carry on.
Oh, so basically, I looked at two of the fact checkers that have been cited, and I don't know if I shall introduce them or you, but there's one is based in the UK, is called Full Fact.
Yes, trustees are established political figures, fact checking links to statistics, reports, basically the sort of data social scientists, civil servants would make use of, uncontroversial, basically, so run of the mill data.
Yes, very much so. So if they're going to rebut, for example, if a politician says something like there are more students, more UK students in full-time education now than ever before, then that's the kind of claim that they would deal with. So it's fairly unremarkable claim. And as you pointed out, the sources of their data is basically, it's the stuff academics and civil servants would use, either in formulating policy or just writing their consultation papers. That one seems to me kind of all above board, although the question there would be, what kinds of fake news stories on Facebook can they really make a ruling over? I would suggest that very few fake news stories are kind of challenging those kinds of data sets. It's much more like kind of propaganda based around foreign policy and conflicts zones rather than something they could busy themselves with. You might wish to move on to the other fact checker, which was this one called First Draft.
Yes, and partners include Bellingcat, that will come up in a moment, BBC News, Sky News, Channel 4 News, The Guardian, International Business Times, The Telegraph, a website that has been clearly established to produce pro-imperial propaganda, and was started by Elliot Higgins, a member of the Atlantic Council.
All right, I'll take over there. Now, the last part there you were reading was basically a definition of Bellingcat. Yeah. I was truly astonished to see that First Draft would partner with an organization like Bellingcat if their aim is to combat fake news. Because Bellingcat itself is most definitely, under the guise of so-called citizen journalism, it is most definitely a propaganda mill. And I have a very good story from the World Socialist website, which points out the way in which Elliot Higgins, who's a nobody basically, like Milo, he was disaffected and living in the UK. I think he's actually from Leicester. Right. And he then relocated to the UK and has since become a member of the Atlantic Council, which is this very pro-NATO, pro-US imperialist outfit. And I'm very dismayed in this First Draft website. It's not simply one mention of Bellingcat. He's actually cited as this kind of intellectual authority on the menace of fake news. Now, to just add a bit of nuance and to be fair, the website First Draft, it is actually interesting the kind of methodology they've developed and how they categorize fake news and what characterizes it. And actually, that could be useful. The problem is, though, as I've just said, is that Bellingcat itself is completely compromised. Now, the example the World Socialist website picked up upon was Elliot Higgins taking it upon himself by, in true, I don't know the easy way to describe this, but are you and Alan familiar with these kinds of websites where it's basically lots of lines joining different things and stuff zoomed in on photographs and bits of YouTube videos? It's like full-on kind of conspiracy stuff where this community of people just analyze bits and pieces that come out into the media and then make their kind of judgment. So Elliot Higgins has appointed himself a kind of expert on armaments. So he looks at pictures from Syria, for example, and then he makes his determination, like who fired those weapons or what kind of attack it was, and by which forces. And so he was debunked utterly by the World Socialist website and by our friend, the MIT professor, Theodore Postol, who we mentioned on a few shows ago because he wrote a very, very enlightening report about this so-called Syrian government chemical attack in I can't name the Syrian village because it's hard to say, but I think we know the attack we're talking about in April. Now, he wrote a report debunking the established version that appeared in the news. So basically, the established version was fake news. Now, Elliot Higgins is someone who basically works from the other angle, which is to do everything he can to assert that whatever attacks happen in Syria, they are launched by Assad. So the first one I think you can mention is this 2013 attack, supposed chemical attack, which Higgins wrote up as an Assad operation.
Yeah, so basically what Higgins did was he put his slant on it. In other words, it was the Syrian government, the regime, Assad's regime as it's now been coined. So Theodore Postol. He completely shredded that report. And in fact, he actually said, you know, quote, this guy doesn't really know what he's talking about. That's the level of information this guy was imparting in his fake news report on this sarin gas attack. Interestingly, the French intelligence services had also released an actual report. And what this Theodore, when he compared the White House report, which was used to then drop 58, 59 rockets on that part of the world. Basically, it turned out Bellingcat got involved and did a hit piece against Theodore and was basically picking out of context a particular date. Completely immaterial, not questioning actually any of the facts that this Theodore Postol had included through being a weapons specialist, a munitions specialist, and being able to cite from looking at very detailed pictures of the site and the fact that the sites were seemingly 30 miles apart. So the French report said it happened 30 miles south than from what the Americans said. And it's just a smokescreen to just add, not balance, because balance, you'd have to come out with truth to do that. This was a hit piece, basically, by Bellingcat. So these are like the attack dogs. So when someone comes out with an element of truth contradicting fake news, then you have another arm of the fake news that kicks into gear that basically tries to rubbish the true news. Could we call it that sounds
well, like... basically the facts. But as you almost said there, basically, not only to rubbish it, but if they had their way working through this fact-checking of Facebook, but just to simply eliminate it at its source.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost to cancel it out.
Definitely, definitely. This would be like having facts on the Syrian conflict. This would be like Facebook turning to the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, the guy out in Coventry looking out of his window.
Well, you see, and this thing with fake news. So we've got the likes of Facebook and Google, and I'm sure other... Twitter will probably be next. They're attacking fake news, and they're doing this by algorithms. And there's one particular thing that they call it informed sharing. This is the buzzword that Facebook use. So I'll give you a little blurb on what they say informed sharing is. Facebook is changing the way it ranks stories through what it has dubbed informed sharing. We found that if reading an article makes people significantly less likely to share it, that may be a sign that a story has misled people in some way. For example, people sharing an article without clicking on it could be a sign that it's a false story. So I don't know about you, Jay, but I was going to say, I read I click on stuff, but I don't always share stuff. But now, seemingly, there's an algorithm on Facebook that would deem that to be probably fake news.
Well, I was just going to say the opposite, which is, as people who listen to the show might have gathered, that my life doesn't consist of much apart from reading. And often I'm basically a friend will place a link to an article which I've already read. Actually, when I look through my friend's links each day, usually I've already read all of it. And so if I share them, I won't bother to click on it to share it. I will just simply share it because I already know the content. So Facebook doesn't seem to be catering to that that situation, or it seems to be basically reading that situation as supposedly a sign that it may be a false story. I'm not really sure how you can reach that conclusion. The other one is, if you read an article and then you're less likely to share it, less likely compared to what?
Well, let's just read that.
I'm not sure what the less likely is.
Let me just finish that sentence off. So it goes, for example, people sharing an article without clicking on it could be a sign that it's a false story, or the headline is potentially misleading. Alternatively, if people are clicking on the link and choosing not to share it, a red flag is raised. So that's basically you not sharing a story is telling Facebook to mark it as fake news for anyone else who comes across it. Which in itself is quite breathtaking, really.
Well, the other part of this, of course, is that if they're using an algorithm, as we've sort of talked about when we go through fake news and first draft and full fact are kind of the way it's described, their methodology. Basically, anything at all that is released by, for example, CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times or the Guardian or the BBC, that is all taken de facto as true. These tests of whether or not the content is fake are not applied to it. These tests are only applied when it's from a non-corporate or non-establishment source. So basically, it's just aimed at everything else. But as we've seen on the internet this week, there's a meme going around at the moment. For example, BBC ran a fake news story. The BBC showed misleading analysis of how Labour's income tax rises would affect people earning £100,000 a year. The BBC graphic, one, it showed 50% rather than 45p, so that number was wrong. And then underneath it said, under Labour's plan, if you earn £100,000 a year, you're going to pay an extra £23,000 in tax. No, you're not. We're going to pay an extra £2,000. Now, you could say the BBC made an honest mistake, although the honest mistakes always seem to only travel in one direction. But to me, that is basically, where is the full fact check for that? Where is the Facebook fact checker kicking in there?
Well,
if the BBC run that story on their website.
How can you mistake £2,000 for 23? I can't see that. You see, there's also this other thing that Facebook is doing in collaboration with Google. Facebook Journalism Project. Have you come across that at all, Jay?
Actually, I did come across that while I was researching this story. I came a lot of interesting things. The other thing that, you can talk about that first. Facebook's also got this thing called Instant Articles, which again, are probably able to bypass this kind of fact-checking mechanism, because basically you're paying Facebook for the way that you position your story on the website. Have you noticed that sometimes you click on a link in Facebook when you're using the mobile device? Now, I like to have all the links open up in the website, you know, in Google Chrome, in a browser. I don't like to read them inside Facebook.
I always go externally to the site.
Well, it used to be that if you had that set in the settings, you know, always open links in an external browser, it would work every single time. But you may have noticed now that sometimes you click on a story and it still opens in Facebook. And then if you want to read it on the website, you have to kind of click share. If you want to read it in a browser, you have to click share and then like open in browser, right?
Yeah. In fact, interestingly with that is I use Firefox, and so I've got it set up on my middle button on my mouse that if I click on a link with my middle button, it will send it automatically open it in an external link. Even when I do that with these posts, it just opens up an external link, but still on Facebook.
That's right, because this is called the Facebook Instant Article. Now, the way this is sold to media organizations is that if you go into partnership with Facebook for positioning your content, basically these pages will open like 70% faster, and also supposedly there's a better percentage of you know, it's more sticky. People are more likely to read through it. I actually detest this kind of being trapped inside Facebook thing, but it's part of Facebook. As part of this, Facebook is kind of running this journalism project alongside. So it's just this kind of interface between, you know, content producers and Facebook. So if you want to talk about the journalism project, you
well,
can go
yeah,
ahead.
It's these UK focused changes. So seemingly, this journalistic kind of project is in the UK, and it's about basically setting up deeper collaborations with news organisations. Interestingly enough, I mean, Alan has just left, but Alan was telling me a few days ago there's a similar project going on in schools in the area, from what he's understood from various people that is in contact with the Word newspaper that Alan runs. And it seems that they're setting up a similar project, and it's teaching students to be, if they're going to use social media as a form of news networking and obtaining their information, they are basically being taught how to differentiate between fake news and real news. And of course, the only problem with that is, who is it that's deciding what's fake news? If you read a story from the BBC, you can trust it's authentic news. But if you get it from anywhere else outside of the very small little list of places that we deem to be suitable, it will be classed as fake news. And this is now going on in schools as well as social media, and it's got to the point now where seemingly a lot of organisations, the BBC, and we'll get to this in a bit, but Facebook's now employing consultants from the Labour Party or the Conservative Party. So they've stepped up their attempts to basically their influence. Would you like to go into more detail with that, Jane?
Well, I think what I would say here is that obviously we can describe these kinds of, why has fake news been why has it been kind of brought to the front of the agenda? And it is really a kind of classic example of what David Icke and likes to call problem reaction solution. Now, for people not familiar with the term, it has a very, very long history. And basically, the idea is you have some kind of measure which you wish to implement, but the public mood, for whatever reason, is not kind of ready for this new idea. And so what you have to do is you have to create the problem. So you create the problem of fake news, and then when you get the reaction, the kind of clamor to do something, well, hey presto, you know, up your sleeve, you've got your solution, which you had there all along. So I think fake news one was placed very high up the agenda because solutions were already ready to come on stream. What's it all about? On one level, what I would compare it to is Facebook is basically cleaning house here, because they want to have ways to clamp down on kind of guerrilla forms of content penetrating their platform, because they wish to sell their users to the mainstream political parties, and maybe to their corporate backers, I suppose. So the two go hand in hand. Labour and the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, they're not going to want to spend quite large sums of money, millions of pounds, if they're going to be competing with all kinds of guerrilla campaigns, like bot armies, all kinds of assaults on the platform. From other actors. So basically, you drive them out, you have a way to filter them out, and then basically the Facebook users are ready. They're all available then, and you can sell your customers to these political parties. So that's what I see it as being, and it certainly makes sense, like you said, in terms of the way Facebook is further trying to integrate itself with the nature of modern political campaigning. And the company itself says that we employed staff whose role it is to help politicians and governments make good use of Facebook. One of the things we're absolutely there to do is to help people make use of Facebook products. As you've pointed out, a Facebook product is a user.
Is a user, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now, the way it works... Oh, sorry. Well, the way it works there then is that the nature of this platform, as Tim Berners-Lee, the guy that kind of invented the World Wide Web, has pointed out, is it allows advertisers to target, literally target an individual with an individually tailored ad to try and push them in a particular direction. You did mention on a previous show, for example, that Facebook were selling advertisers knowledge of good moments to hit teenagers with products that might cheer them up when they're feeling sad. Well, this is the same kind of logic applied to the political scene. So Tim Berners-Lee points out that there may be 50,000 variations of a single ad, and this, I suppose they use computer software to carry it out, to deliver it, but it will reach an individual. It may be that a single individual just sees that one ad and no one else sees it. I don't know if you have the clip there of an example of one of these ads.
Yeah, I do. And in fact, and this was interesting because obviously we were going to cover this last week and we didn't have time. And in 7 days, one of these ads has come to light. And actually, it makes sense. If you take this ad, and it's not very long, and you were to break up, there's quite a few edits in the ad where it goes from different scenarios. And if you was to take each scenario as, say, a queuing point, then you would have a whole list of queuing points, and you would be able to select any variation of these selected editing points and then put them together for your tailored ad. So this is the Facebook tailored advert conservative.
Brexit must mean control of the number of people who come to Britain from Europe. And that is what we will deliver.
Do you think too many people from other parts of the EU have come to live and work in the UK?
No, I don't think too many have come.
Right. And I don't know what that sound was at the end. I think that's the stamp of approval that they put on the video. The Laura Kunzberg, of course, she's got to be involved in a bit of political advertising for the Conservative Party. Now, that, to me, Jay, that sounds like quite a racist advert.
Yes, and as we said, how is, for example, if we're going to talk about fact-checking and these kinds of claims that are made, well, is that being applied to this kind of political campaigning? We have absolutely no idea what kinds of ads are going out because they could be just sent to single individuals and there's never any record of it. How are we going to find out? Today they have announced that there will be some kind of inquiry into this whole issue of Facebook and political advertising. So when we read into that, we might find out a little more about it. But I'm so glad that you've got the example there. And you describe very well the way that they may use those queuing points. I remember, you know, for example, when you're on the London Underground and you hear the person announcing the stations you're at.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Exactly.
They have this software where the person doesn't actually read the name, you know, Bakerloo, Blackfriars. They don't. They just read like the consonant clusters and the vowels, and the software can basically, you type in what you want the voice to say, and it will say it.
Yeah, that is and fascinating kind of technology.
Computer voices, when you get the robocalls, they'll be doing the same thing. So as you just explained, a computer can chop up those bits and pieces to shuffle them around and just tip them out in whichever way that the software has decided is most likely to persuade the target to modify their beliefs. It does seem to be kind of threatening to the democratic process. Basically because, and we did talk about this together, which is it used to be that polling data would be analysed after the election. And so after the election, they'd come on the TV and say, well, the professors have sat down or the civil servants, and they've worked out that the swing voters, the undecideds that that carried the day for one party or the other were these guys and girls in these constituencies around the UK. It was these seats which basically were decisive, right?
Right. You see, I mean,
that used to be the traditional model, Dave. But the thing is, now they can work it out before the election happens.
Yeah,
so it's
in
all
real time,
before the fact.
In real time, basically, as it goes along, as it progresses, they're always accumulating the data. So every evening, someone could sit down and go through the paperwork, but then obviously if it's all mathematics, it's all digital data, so you just run it through a particular number of filters and then you'll be able to subdivide all the data in its respective little groups, and then you'll be able to say these people fancy this, this many people fancied that, And there you go. There's your result.
I suppose the only thing you could say is that if all the political parties, well, again, it will be the mainstream political parties who can throw the most money at this. If all three throw lots and lots of resources at it and they all gain maximum efficiency, well, then I guess it just means that the result kind of cancels itself out in terms of what they can do. Or basically you say, well, they've maximized, each one maximized their potential vote. So, you know.
It's what you said last week when we sort of teased this particular story, this Facebook stuff, where, you know, when they started including the emoticons under posts, so you didn't just have to like something. And as you stated, rightly so, that it's there to basically gather emotional data on people. So, interestingly, recently, McDonald's, we all thought they was failing. I mean, currently in Rochdale doesn't even have a McDonald's. That's how bad it is here.
All those Russians.
Yeah, the McDonald's basically couldn't afford a rent and left. Now, they had an advert, McDonald's, and it was slated by various people because it was using the emotion of grief. Now, if I've lost a parent, I know you have, Jay, and any of those listening. So we have first-hand experience of grief. It's not a particularly pleasant experience. So to be... I watched this advert for research purposes and generally quite appalled by it. Basically, it's a young son with his mother. The father's obviously passed away. And the son keeps comparing himself and asking his mum about his father. And, of course, the father was handsome. All the women loved him, great sense of humour, really clever bloke, and of course the son is nothing like this. He end up in McDonald's, and just as the kid is about to tuck into his burger, the mother turns around and says, "Ah, that was your dad's favourite," and then she looks out the window reflecting, and then she says, "Ah, yes, he used to dribble down his chin with it," and then she looks back and there's the son wiping all the sauce off his chin, and she's like, as a moment, right? And as you, when I was explaining this to you, Jay, you said, is there anything that they won't use to sell a product? I think the answer is no.
Well, we're just, the link here between Facebook and McDonald's is the kind of advertising, isn't it? And the extremes it can be taken to. The other thing I should have said just before we did move on was that if you are one of these people that these algorithms have identified as kind of, you know, you're going to carry the day when the election happens. When I lived in the US, you know, it's very well developed, this kind of science. And what would happen is if you live in a town which is going to be quite important, sometimes when you turn on the TV, it's literally political adverts the entire time. Some of these people, they'll have like 40,000 ad spots during the campaign over the local TV channels. So literally, if you're caught in the crosshairs, so there may be someone out there using Facebook who's just literally, you know, I never see any of these political adverts, but they may just be sat there. And unfortunately, they're one of these people. They're just sat there being thousands of ads on their timeline. That would be the kind of nightmare scenario. To turn the attention to the McDonald's thing here. Now, I was just thinking a little more kind of from the reading experience here. Now, there's an American sociologist called Arlie Hochschild or Hochschild. Have you heard of her?
I haven't, no. Who's she?
Well, she came up with the term, a concept, which, you know, of course, if you're an academic, you always make your name if a concept becomes identified with you, if you coin a new concept. Now, the one that she coined was emotional labour.
Okay, and the definition of that would be?
Well, basically, what you used to see is that when you did your job, for example, you do your job, you just do your job, right? Your job would just be the tasks, they'd be the duties.
Yeah, responsibilities and so on, yeah.
Yeah. Now, when you get into emotional labour, and I had a very good article I could put up on the website, it took at its departure point. Have you heard of the company called Pret-a-Manger? I think it's called, or Pret-a-Manger, as it's probably called by the customers in England. But they sell sandwiches and coffee.
Okay. So sandwiches and coffee.
So what it was when they train their workers now, and I'm sure as I begin to discuss this, the penny's going to kind of drop in terms of what emotional labor is. When they train their workers, they have this system where basically the reactions of your co-workers and the people above you in the organization are all part of your training process. So basically you're all kind of committed to taking up certain kinds of roles, certain kinds of emotions regarding one another. Now, what will happen is they're observing your emotional state, and when you're performing your job, you know, you've got to do all your stuff with a big smile on your face, because customers want to see when they come in the door, you know, a certain emotion coming out of you. So emotional labor is basically you being required not only to do your job, but to do it while, you know, having the appropriate emotions while doing so. So this pret-a-manger company, it becomes a science, you know, the way they do it. So it's they'll have some kind of black mark if you are looking sad. And so someone co-worker will take you aside, and they have kind of group sessions where you all have to express your kind of positivity and affirm one another.
Do you know?
So it's very kind of cultish.
Do you know what that reminds me of? I've got this image of National Lampoon's Animal House, where they're in the frat house and they're being paddled, and the guy's bending over and he's getting slapped on the ass with a paddle. He's going, "Thank you, sir. Can I please have another slap?" Same kind of thing, then, isn't it? Really?
Well, the link there would be that is in the kind of the employment situation. And also, I think you've had some experience maybe of the DWP. Now, when they use these social kinds of workshop situations, they are very much engaged in trying to control your emotions or make you perform a certain set of emotions in terms of what they have decided that this is what employers need to see. You know, they don't just need to see the skills that you can do the job, but it's a certain attitude towards work,
yes,
for example.
Oh, yeah.
So they're basically trying to tell you that the reason that you can't find a job, or the key to finding a job, is not always necessarily like the skills in terms of, you know, how fast you can type or what your formal qualifications, but instead it's more about your demeanor, the kind of person you are, the feeling people get when they're around you. So it becomes, you know, almost indistinguishable from a kind of therapy, a therapeutic kind of approach, where basically the reason you can't get a job ultimately is you. You are the problem and you are the reason.
That's, yeah, so you're being judged on your temperament, basically.
Now, the link there, finally, hopefully it's become clear with the McDonald's advert now, and why the McDonald's advert is kind of so awful, is because basically, by replaying that kind of scenario there of grief, the viewer is almost being compelled to identify or make reference to their own grief. So I'm almost being forced, you know, to perform the emotional labor on behalf of the McDonald's corporation there of recalling my own dead parent. That's kind of their key.
That's the thing that actors do, isn't it? That's what actors do, emotional recall.
Well, to do it and to go so far, to be basically trying to bring out those very personal and kind of profound feelings that aren't always comfortable feelings, simply to hawk some cheeseburgers and some French fries, you know, that would be, for me, why it would be kind of, you know, I'm not saying it's unacceptable to do that, but I'd certainly question the decency of that. I don't really feel that is necessary simply in order to sell a cheeseburger. And some, we know what a McDonald's is. There's no one alive that doesn't know what a McDonald's meal is. And to make it kind of so wrenching just to try and grab you, just find that to be just utterly lacking in judgment.
So, I mean, you earlier on in the show, you mentioned about the hack that happened that affected XP machines and obviously the NHS computers here. Now, while I was looking into that, I stumbled across this story where Google had, I say, this was a year old, this story, and I never had heard about this beforehand until recently. Google had basically had access to, was it 1.6 million patients on the NHS, their medical records, basically. Was it a data sharing agreement between Google-owned artificial intelligence company DeepMind and the Royal Free NHS Trust gives the clearest picture, basically your information, of, and it's 1.6 million patients who pass through three London hospitals, and that information is now being passed on to Google, and this particular private company called DeepMind, which business is artificial intelligence. So if you live in Barnet or Chase Farm and Royal Free, these are the hospitals, your basically data is going to this. As I said to you the other day, Jay, why does Google need people's healthcare? Well, delivering services, maybe, I can understand that. But not telling the patients. There was a thing, actually, was it a couple of years ago? When the default setting, and we find this on Windows 10, that default setting is share everything, right? That you had to opt out of this scheme because the default setting was that you would basically, your data would be shared with third-party partners, in this case, DeepMind, a subsidiary company of Google. What do you reckon?
Well, I'm trying to see the link necessarily between the McDonald's ad and this kind of DeepMind thing, but...
Well, it's not much of an...
I'm not so sure. Now, you just kind of bring that up at the end of the show, I know. So, the thing I think there is, I would say, is that... and the Conservatives have kind of... One thing about... I'll just pick up on Conservatives just to round off the show, actually, because we're kind of open with them, and I'll bring it back round to the Conservatives.
Because I've got a great...
The future of the NHS... is a very major issue at this election. Now, one thing that the Tories know is they know how to sniff out, you know, how to make a penny. And what they've realized is in this big data society that we're discussing in this last segment is, I will tell you the basic fact there, which is the data is worth more than the patients.
Yeah. That data is massive business. People are like... a haphazard side effect because it's people that create data. So, yeah.
Now, one part of this, maybe, this is what I imagine for the future of the NHS, is the Tories will not actually want to break up the bureaucracy of the NHS because the data is worth a lot more if we keep having a centralised database. So they wouldn't want to fracture the system, actually. They will want to tie everyone into this system because that is the most effective big sell. You know, a system that has everyone on it. So they'll want to keep that part. But what will happen is they're going to add extra kind of layers in between for how you get the services. And what I imagine is Google are the masters at the moment of these kinds of data mining. So what's going to happen is Google will be able to data mine. And the idea there will be perhaps, for example, one thing that the Tories do love is the idea that you won't rack up expenses for the health service because what we're going to do is intervene. So Google maybe can supply stuff about obesity indicators, things like that.
Oh, and sorry about that, Jay.
Sorry. Just to go back there, it's kind of like we said in the DWP kind of situation there, is that what you'll find is that everything about your health status will relate to you. It will be all about you. So when you're ill, you'll be given all kinds of tasks and interventions, you know, short of receiving any actual kind of expensive care. So what's going to happen is just lots of these messages, perhaps, for people at risk of diabetes and things. Google will be supplying those NHS trusts with, like, ways to give you alerts and try and do some kind of preventive stuff to kind of encourage efficiency that way. But as you said, the only possible link can be is that Google are the data masters. But whether we want them, whether or not it gets turned towards good ends or bad, is largely dependent on what the people who receive Google's analyses wish to do.
Well, okay. So to finish up with, it's 6 o'clock. We best finish up. So I'd found a chunky mark, as we mentioned earlier on, and I'd like to finish up on that. So this is about, you mentioned it earlier on, where you are going to be given the opportunity not to work for a year, but to look after your grandma or a family relative. So we'll just play this and then we'll do the outro of the show.
Headlines, Theresa May's the most progressive workers' rights reforms by a Conservative ever. You're like, what, really? Go on then, what's your policies? What are they? We will let you take a year off work and look after a parent or a family member unpaid because our brutal austerity programme has smashed the living daylights out of social care, and a country can't afford to look after your nana sitting in her faeces, so you're going to be allowed to do it for free. But you've got to leave work. That's workers' rights. You've got to leave work to look after your nana sitting in her faeces. Bloody John Humphreys interviewing Damien Green, the Minister for the Department of Work and Pensions, heir to bloody Ian Duncan Smith, was pitiful. Green was admitting carers and allowance, you cannot live on it. It's not for living on. People should find other monies, he said. Other monies. What other monies? What other monies, you bonehead? But we're fed bloody propaganda media. The entire country's being let down. The Tories hate the working class. They literally hate you. This pitch is like saying, listen, you're clueless. Look, we brought you slavery. We brought you the workhouses. We brought you the mines. Now we're bringing you zero-hour contracts. Now you got treasonous workers' rights. Nothing. Nada nish. No work. Nothing. Unpaid. Just looking after the people that you're going to fend for yourself. Start begging on your knees. That's treason's workers' rights.
Yeah, workers' rights, no work. 0 hours, contracts. That's generally what that is. What do you think, Jay?
What I think is it's time to end the show, Dave, and thank everyone for listening. Now, no one did follow us on the Twitter account, which is Inside Track DJ, but if anyone did, I will follow them back on behalf of the show. And I just want to thank you, Dave, and to thank Alan, and to thank everyone who listens.
Excellent. And top work on your Blue Peter microphone stand and pop filter, by the way, Jay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Enjoy your week, and we shall speak to you same time, same place next week. See you later, all. Have fun.